Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 91.9 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1150, I will air an interview the Electronic Intifada conducted with Abid Ayyub, National Executive Director for ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, talking about the U.S. government's escalating attack on those who speak up for Palestinian rights and what can be done to protect ourselves individually and collectively. I will also share with you a statement released by Palestine Legal on Trump's executive order aiming to punish protests of Israel's genocide in Gaza and promotes anti-Palestinian discrimination. Let's first begin with the latest Electronic Intifada newscast.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 12 of the ceasefire after 471 days of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and Lebanon. Palestinians who have spent the last 15 months displaced from their homes and communities in Gaza have begun to return. On Wednesday, the Gaza government media office stated that more than 500,000 forcibly displaced persons have returned to the northern governorates since the withdrawal on Monday of Israeli occupation forces from the Netzarim corridor, which split Gaza in half. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud, reporting from Gaza City on Wednesday, said that, quote, "Everything has been destroyed, from the public facilities to the residential buildings. There's nothing left. There are areas we spent over half an hour driving by where all we saw was sheer destruction," he added. "Entire residential neighborhoods have been wiped off the map. In some areas, there are no signs of destroyed homes at all, as everything was completely bulldozed. Not even the rubble exists anymore. We also saw some families returning to homes that are damaged. They stood in front of the homes for hours, wondering where and how to start. The joy of returning to northern Gaza has faded away in the face of the massive heartbreak and disappointment. As people return to their homes, or what is left of their homes, in northern Gaza, civil defense and paramedic crews say they continue to retrieve the decomposed remains of Palestinians in multiple locations along the coastal road that had been occupied and closed by Israeli forces. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said that it had recovered at least 14 bodies on the road, and the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 59 bodies of people killed in previous Israeli attacks have been recovered from the rubble on Wednesday alone. More than 400 bodies have been retrieved since the January 19th ceasefire. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have continued to attack Palestinians in Gaza. The Palestine Red Crescent reported on Wednesday that Israeli snipers shot at one of the ambulances while it was, quote, "carrying out an urgent mission in the Tel Sultan area west of Rafah in the south." The United Nations stated that on Monday, January 27th, a girl was killed and others injured when an animal-driven cart was hit on Al-Rashid Road, northwest of An-Nusayrat, while returning towards the north. On the same day, the UN says a man was reportedly killed and others injured when a bulldozer was hit in Al-Nuairi area, northwest of Nusayrat. Abu Bakr Abed, reporting for Drop Site News, writes that more than 80 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire began, including 49 in Rafah alone. Dr. Zahar Al-Wahidi, the Palestinian Health Ministry's information director, told Abu Bakr and Drop Site News that, quote, "We need caterpillars and bulldozers to clear up the wreckage and recover these corpses. People are getting back to literally nothing. Rafah is destroyed and the killing and bombing continue there. Nearly 700 bodies are still trapped under the rubble in Rafah. Retrieving them mainly depends on allowing this essential machinery that can help with this cumbersome mission." The Gaza government media office reported on January 28th that civil security crews have worked to neutralize dangerous remnants of Israeli weaponry across the Gaza Strip. Quote, specialized teams have made strenuous efforts over the past days to remove unexploded ordnance and missiles and secure residential areas, which contributed to reducing potential risks to the lives of civilians, especially children who are exposed to these remnants while playing in the affected areas, the media office stated. The steady flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the work of local mutual aid organizations are providing life-saving supplies for Palestinians starved and sickened by Israel's genocidal siege. 14 Turkish aid ships carrying more than 870 tons of supplies, power generators, portable toilets, and thousands of tents and blankets arrived at the Arish port in Egypt on Wednesday. The Egyptian government said that the Rafah border crossing is set to reopen within days and that the Egyptian side of the crossing is ready for operation. North Sinai Governor Khaled Mojawer told the Anadolu news agency that, quote, the problem lies with the Palestinian side due to the damage caused by the Israeli military operations. The Palestinian side of the Rafah crossing has been forcibly closed and destroyed by Israel since early May. The World Food Program stated that it brought more food to people in Gaza during the first 4 days of the ceasefire than what it could previously dispatch on average per month. The UN reports that on Tuesday, January 28th, 13 of its supported bakeries began operating at full capacity, 8 in Deir el-Balah and 5 in Khan Yunus. These include 8 bakeries that had previously closed due to flour shortages and 5 new ones, the UN added. The Samir Project, a local mutual aid organization, said their volunteers distributed 51,000 liters of fresh water in Jabalia and Gaza City on Wednesday and provided free transportation to around 500 people returning from the south to the north. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, said that it had significantly scaled up its humanitarian operations in Gaza since the ceasefire began, including delivering more than 500,000 food parcels in just 9 days. The agency said on Wednesday that nearly 370 pallets of essential medications, including insulin syringes sufficient for over 17,000 people suffering from diabetes for 8 months, as well as laboratory and dental supplies, have also been dispatched to UNRWA-run health facilities, including in Deir el-Balah, Nuseirat, Al-Mawasi, and the Beach Health Center in Gaza Governorate, where services have been restored this week. More than 1,000 UNRWA healthcare providers have held appointments with nearly 14,000 patients and have supported solid waste collection efforts in 4 Gaza municipalities. UNRWA has also distributed hygiene items, potable and domestic water and shelter supplies, such as tarpaulins and blankets, to hundreds of families across Gaza, while about 22,000 tents are in the pipeline ready to enter the Strip. However, the Israeli Knesset activated legislation it passed last month to order the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, to cease operations as of today. Philippe Lazzarini, UNRWA's Commissioner General, spoke to the UN Security Council on Tuesday, saying that, quote, full implementation of the Knesset legislation will be disastrous. In Gaza, undermining UNRWA's operations will compromise the international humanitarian response. It will degrade the capacity of the United Nations just when humanitarian assistance must be scaled up significantly. This will only worsen the already catastrophic living conditions of millions of Palestinians. As of this broadcast, UNRWA says that it has not received any official communication on how the Israeli parliament's bills banning UNRWA will be implemented. We'll have more on Israel's attempts to undermine the agency in the coming weeks. The spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, Asim Al-Nabi, who is also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada, reported that municipal engineers and workers have been assessing the damage to the city's water networks and planning the repairs as people return to the north. The water supply is only reaching 40% of the city's total area, Anabi stated, and the amount of water available to residents is extremely limited and falls far short of meeting their basic needs. Water networks have suffered severe damage, he added, and 75% of the central water wells have been damaged during the war. However, the delivery of fuel, which Israel had heavily restricted during the last 15 months, is helping to operate some of the sewage systems and water sources. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, says that its delivery of 10,000 liters of fuel has enabled the Palestinian Water Authority to resume operation of sewage pumps and water wells in North Gaza for the first time in 3 months. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of A Graveyard of Stones by Rasha Abu Jalal, writing from Gaza. Rasha profiles three Palestinians who are returning or preparing to return to their homes in the north or in the south after more than a year of forced displacement. She writes, quote, "On the roof of a cart piled high with children and luggage, Isam Abu Maher, 39, stared at the long road ahead of him. Abu Maher was heading back to see his hometown of Huza, east of Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip, from where he had been forced to leave, along with all Huza's residents, in December 2023. Everyone on board the vehicle on January 20th seemed happy that their displacement was over and the road to Huza was crowded. But as soon as Abu Maher's vehicle arrived in the town, joy turned into shock. The devastation was beyond imagination. Streets had been bulldozed, homes had been completely destroyed, and piles of rubble were everywhere. Abu Maher stood in the middle of the rubble that was once his home, picking up a handful of dirt between his fingers as if trying to restore the memory of the place. I thought we were returning to our homes, but we returned to a graveyard of stones. No walls or doors, just rubble and the memories buried beneath it," Abu Maher told the Electronic Intifada. Still determined to stay in their hometown, Abu Maher, like other residents of the town, pitched his tent in front of the ruins of his old home. "If I am destined to live in a tent, let it be on top of the rubble of my home, here in my neighborhood and among my neighbors." "He is anxious," he said. "He has no idea when reconstruction might begin or if it even will. I fear that the wait for reconstruction will be long, that we will remain under tents forever, that these ruins will become our new home." That is an excerpt from A Graveyard of Stones by Rasha Abu Jalal on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israel has carried out a series of airstrikes and attacks on Palestinians in the north over the last week. On Wednesday, yesterday, 10 Palestinians were killed in an airstrike on Tamun near Tubas, according to the Wafa news agency. A Palestinian boy was shot and injured by Israeli forces in Tulkarm also on Wednesday, as Israeli soldiers continued a three-day raid into the city. The United Nations reports that access to water and electricity has been disrupted in Tulkarm, and initial estimates suggest nearly 1,000 people have been displaced. On January 27th, Israeli forces carried out several raids around the Ramallah area. Meanwhile, the Israeli siege on Jenin and the Jenin refugee camp has continued for the second week. My colleague Tamara Nassar reported earlier this week that about 2,000 Palestinian families have been forcibly displaced from Jenin as a result of Israel's deadly raid. The Israeli invasion is a continuation of the Palestinian authorities' dirty work in the camp, she adds, which saw the killing of 15 Palestinians, including three children, between early December and January 17th, as the Israeli army now, quote, "seeks to reach several targets that PA forces have failed to," according to the Tel Aviv daily Haaretz. The news publication Arabs 48 reports that Israeli forces have expanded their military aggression, driving military vehicles and bulldozers into Jenin, demolishing and burning homes and destroying the local infrastructure. On Tuesday, Israeli forces demolished the Hamza Mosque in Jenin camp and raided Palestinians' homes in preparation for destroying them. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, said on Wednesday that Israeli army forces will continue to occupy Jenin refugee camp. In a video statement, Katz said, quote, "The camp will not return to what it was. Even after the operation ends, Israeli forces will stay to ensure that," quote, "terrorism does not return." Israeli soldiers have now killed at least 16 Palestinians and injured and arrested dozens, and at least 100 homes inside the camp have been destroyed, according to local news sources. On Sunday, January 26th, an Israeli sniper shot and killed a 16-year-old child, Adam Majdi Ahmed Sublaban, near the Qalandia checkpoint north of Jerusalem. Defense for Children International Palestine stated that Adam and two other children were walking in the area where no tensions were present. Adam was struck in the left thigh from behind, resulting in severe bleeding due to the injury to the femoral artery in the thigh. In occupied East Jerusalem, Israeli forces have reportedly arrested 12 Palestinians who celebrated the release of prisoners as part of the Gaza ceasefire. Israel's police and internal spy agency, the Shin Bet, said they arrested them after videos emerged showing them celebrating by waving Hamas flags and firing guns into the air. They alleged that the men violated a ban on expressions of joy and identification with Hamas that has been imposed since the ceasefire in Gaza took hold. The violent arrests in the context of the prohibition on expressions of joy by Israeli forces have prompted the Palestinian Prisoners Society to appeal to international mediators to intervene against, quote, systematic terrorism against released prisoners and their families. According to the prisoners' rights group, Israeli forces have threatened to bomb places where well-wishers of the released prisoners have gathered, while other released prisoners have faced rearrest and detention. On Monday, quote, Israeli forces summoned the released prisoner Ashwaq Awad to meet Israeli intelligence. In this context, the Palestinian Prisoners Society expressed its fears that Israel could rearrest the released prisoners, especially under Military Order No. 1651, which allows this to happen even under exchange deals. On Saturday, January 25th, Israeli forces shot and killed a two-year-old girl, Leila Mohammed Ayman Khatib, while she ate dinner with her family in their home near Jenin, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. They say that Israeli soldiers shot four bullets through the living room window, one of which struck Leila in the back of the head. Leila's grandfather carried her out of the house and brought her to Al-Razi Hospital in Jenin, where she received emergency surgery. Leila was pronounced dead around 10 p.m., the rights group stated. Ayad Abu Akhtesh, Accountability Program Director at DCIP, stated, quote, Israeli forces regularly and routinely carry out military operations with complete contempt for Palestinian life. Little Leila was having dinner with her family when Israeli forces, unprompted, fired live ammunition into their living room, killing her. It is outrageous that the Israeli military has been permitted by world leaders to kill Palestinian children with impunity in flagrant violations of international law. Leila's mother and aunt sustained injuries from the shrapnel during the attack, according to information collected by DCIP. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq stated on Wednesday that, quote, the genocidal rhetoric and incitement from Israeli officials, which has characterized the atrocities in Gaza, is increasingly applied to all Palestinians. The decades-long failure of the international community and of high contracting parties to the Geneva Conventions to stand up against Israel's manifest violations of international law facilitates the climate of impunity by which Israeli authorities are perpetrating its genocidal, colonial violence against the Palestinian people. Al-Haq adds, to put an end to such violence, all states must immediately abide by their obligations under international law, particularly in light of the ICJ advisory opinion of July 2024, requiring that Israel end its illegal presence in and remove settlers from the occupied Palestinian territories. And in Lebanon, Israeli forces have injured dozens of people in the last 4 days, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. Under the terms of the ceasefire agreement, which was extended 3 more weeks last weekend after a 60-day truce, the Israeli army was expected to withdraw from southern Lebanon on Sunday. However, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said it would keep soldiers in the country beyond the deadline, Al Jazeera reported. The Reuters news agency reported that Israeli forces killed at least 24 people and wounded more than 140 in southern Lebanon on Sunday and Monday, the Lebanese Health Ministry said, as thousands of people tried to return to their homes in the area in defiance of Israeli military orders. In a speech on Monday, Hezbollah's Secretary General Naim Qassem said that Israel has violated the ceasefire in Lebanon 1,350 times, while the resistance group has upheld it. Quote, we are facing an occupation that continues to attack and refuses to withdraw, and the resistance has the right to determine how, when, and in what form it confronts them, Qassem stated. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to share images of people expressing determination and resilience in the aftermath of Israel's 15-month campaign of destruction and genocide. Cats and dogs were among the hundreds of thousands of people and their families returning home to the north. One cat named Busi came with her family to the south and was returning to the north. Her person says, quote, "I love her a lot and got attached to her a lot during the war." Another young man holds three cats and says they're being returned to the north as well after being fed and looked after. Quote, "Learn humanity from the Gaza Strip," the man says. And a child with his small dog Lucy smiles as he walks to the north. And finally, our contributor Abu Bakr Abed posted these photos of graffiti along the road where Palestinians marched from the south to the north. The first one says, "Welcome to the land of the great. Here is Gaza." Number two says, "Greetings to you for what you have endured." The third says, "Enter in peace and safety." And the fourth one is a line from a famous poem. The hashtags all say the same thing. Here is Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different U.S. and European cities. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. One of the many executive orders signed by President Trump over the past few days is Executive Order Number 13,899, titled Additional Measures to Combat Anti-Semitism. Palestine Legal, an independent organization dedicated to protecting the civil and constitutional rights of people in the U.S. who speak out for Palestinian freedom, released a statement on January 30, 2025, on Trump's executive order, saying it aims to punish protests of Israel's genocide in Gaza and promotes anti-Palestinian discrimination. Palestine Legal statement says, quote, "Donald Trump signed an executive order targeting university students who participate in protests or speech activity critical of Israel's genocide. The order reaffirms and expands on Trump's 2019 executive order that directed government agencies to consider the distorted and politicized IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which brands virtually all speech critical of Israel as anti-Jewish when investigating federal civil rights complaints. The order follows a January 20th expanded travel ban executive order that calls for extensive vetting, including ideological litmus tests, to justify banning entry to or removing non-citizen students and others who support Palestinian rights or critique U.S. policy. The January 29th executive order directs government agencies to report on possible civil and criminal actions they can take to curb or combat anti-Semitism. It also calls on government agencies to recommend trainings for universities to be able to identify, monitor, and report on non-citizen students and staff based on broadly defined security-related inadmissibility grounds, including any unlawful activity. Its wider impact will be to sow a climate of fear and suspicion on campus and to chill speech critical of Israel or supportive of Palestinian rights. Alongside ongoing efforts by the government to strong-arm universities into policing and punishing Palestine scholarship and activism, this new Trump directive aims to further co-opt universities as arms of the surveillance state and will disproportionately impact Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and other students of color," unquote. Again, that was part of the statement issued by Palestine Legal. Dima Khalidi, Palestine Legal Director, said, quote, This order is the latest in a growing list of dangerous authoritarian measures aimed at enforcing an ideological strangulation on schools by attempting to scare students into silence about Israel's genocide in Gaza with threats of persecution and deportation. It strikes at the heart of students' free speech rights. Its true goal is not to stop anti-Semitism, in which Trump and his sycophants frequently traffic, but to stop the growing support in this country for Palestinian liberation. Targeting Palestine rights activists for punishment violates the First Amendment. The executive order is racist at its core and reaffirms Trump's anti-Palestinian bigotry and his close cooperation with pro-Israel groups that have long encouraged discriminatory targeting of Palestinians and Palestine supporters. The executive order tells Palestinians and allies that voicing opposition to Israel's oppression of Palestinians can be grounds to deport or punish them. The implications of this executive order go far beyond the Palestine movement. It encourages government agencies to find ways to target and dissent from Trump's agenda and aims to enlist universities themselves as its censors and snitches. It is imperative that universities protect the rights of their students, refuse to cooperate with Trump's efforts to silence and criminalize dissent, and end the McCarthyite crackdowns of students speaking out for Palestinian rights. Unquote. Now, that was Dima Khalidi speaking with Palestine. She's the Palestine Legal Director. The statement by Palestine Legal continues to say, quote, since October 23rd, Palestine Legal has documented a surge of anti-Palestinian racism and censorship across colleges and universities. The scale of repression and violence targeting students for exercising their First Amendment protected expression and association has been unprecedented. U.S. elected officials and university leaders disingenuously accuse students and professors of anti-Semitism to justify the McCarthyite targeting of Palestinians and their allies. This executive order builds on the decades-long effort of anti-Palestinian groups and lawmakers to censor criticism of Israel on college campuses and appears to follow recommendations in right-wing authoritarian playbooks for this administration to isolate, purge, and punish individuals who dare call for Israel's and its U.S. backers' accountability for genocide and war crimes. Unquote. That was the statement released by Palestine Legal. Now, during the Electronic Intifada's January 30th, 2025 livestream, Ali Abu Nama, executive director of the Electronic Intifada, and Noura Burrows Friedman, staff writer and associate editor at the Electronic Intifada, interviewed Abid Ayyub, National Executive Director for ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, about the U.S. government's escalating attack on those who speak up for Palestinian rights and what can be done to protect ourselves individually and collectively. Let's listen to that interview, and I just want to say we are glad that Ali Abu Nama, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and its executive director, is back in the United States free after being arrested and held in Swiss jail for 3 days when he went to Europe to speak at an event. Let's listen to that interview now with Abid Ayyub.
I'm Ali Abu Nama, here with my colleague Noura Burrows Friedman. U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order on Wednesday pledging to deport college students on student visas and others who take part in protests calling for Palestinian rights. The civil rights group Palestine Legal said last month that our view is that Trump is in fact poised to escalate repression of the movement and undermine our constitutional rights to speak out and organize with many of the same tools that he will inherit from the Biden administration and its unwavering support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. During the genocide in Gaza, according to Palestine Legal, these tools of repression have included surveillance, arrests, criminal charges, lawsuits, false definitions of anti-Semitism that prevent criticism of Israel, McCarthyite congressional hearings, and weaponizing civil rights laws in an attempt to threaten university funding. Meanwhile, Harvard University has just settled a lawsuit brought by Zionist students who allege that Palestine solidarity activism on campus is a form of harassment. Student-led Palestine solidarity protests during Israel's genocide in Gaza were cited as a source of so-called anti-Semitic rhetoric against pro-Israel students. In addition to awarding the pro-Israel student group financial compensation, Harvard University has agreed to implement the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which has long been a goal of the Israel lobby, in fact, of the Israeli government and its lobby, that institutions use this definition. And under the IHRA definition, criticism of Israel and the policies of the state, as well as Israel's official ideology, Zionism, are considered anti-Jewish bigotry. Harvard also said it would provide training on combating anti-Semitism and that its Office for Community Conduct would incorporate the IHRA definition when reviewing complaints of discrimination. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, is one of many civil rights organizations that has expressed concern over Harvard's adoption of the IHRA definition and has warned the university of the dire consequences for Arab Americans and indeed anyone speaking up for Palestinian rights. In a statement, ADC said that, quote, with Harvard taking on this definition and setting a precedent, it is imperative that other universities do not follow suit. We reject the need for any legislative definition of anti-Semitism, as it serves only to stifle necessary discourse rather than address true discrimination against Jewish people. And of course, the draconian government crackdowns on activists, students, and journalists engaged around justice for Palestine are escalating in many countries, especially in Europe, as I learned myself just in the last week. Joining us to talk about the repression of activists and journalists on and off college campuses is Abid Ayyub. Abid is the executive director of the ADC. Abid, it's so great to have you back on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you, Ali. It's great to see you and have you back as well, and appreciate, you know, being on here with you and talking about this issue, which really over the past week we've, you know, seen how it can impact us directly.
Yeah, thank you, Abid. And really, before anything else, I want to take this opportunity to thank you and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee for the unqualified statement of support for me that you made after I was arbitrarily detained in Switzerland. Of course, it wasn't just a defense of me as an individual, but of all our fundamental rights. And knowing that you are there for us and our community really empowers us to keep doing our work. So I truly appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's talk about the executive order signed yesterday by Donald Trump, threatening those on student visas with deportation if they criticize Israel or express a positive opinion of Hamas. As a civil rights lawyer and legal expert, how do you analyze the impact this could have on students, their right to free speech, and of course, their right to protest, colonialism, and genocide?
This is going to have a significant impact. And I think the impact is starting now, right? Where whenever there's an attack on free speech and freedom of expression, the first intent of those doing the attacking, the first intent is to stifle speech to give that chilling effect. So we're already hearing from international students and many of the national student groups in the country that, you know, most of their international student members are backing off, or they're afraid to stay engaged, or they don't want to be at protests or be as visible as they were. That's the first immediate impact. And that shows, you know, the intention of this is to stifle these voices that are standing up for justice and for Palestine. Moving forward, you know, the threat of taking away the visa simply because somebody is speaking up, this needs to be a concern for all Americans, everyone in the country, not just Arabs or Muslims or Palestinians. These tactics, giving this precedent to a president and authority to the government to deport you, arrest you, go after you, it's going to start with international students. But it's not going to stop there. We're going to see attack on journalists. We're going to see attack on others coming into this country, speakers. And I do want to keep in mind that there's two orders. There was the one signed yesterday, and then there was the one signed on his first day, which, you know, kind of went around the same lines of attack. The same, you know, they were threatening us around the same thing. Sorry, my phone. And these coupled together, it's an attack on free speech. It's an attack on our identity and who we are. And it's attack not just on us, on our allies. Remember, you know, we're not talking here that every international student is Palestinian or Arab. we have a limited number of international students in this country. So the international students they're going to be going after, they're going to see like a diverse, the diversity, they're going to see students from across the world. So it is something to be concerned thing, something that we're, you know, we should be watching, and all Americans should be, you know, concerned of right now.
Abid, there are probably international students watching this program. I know that you can't give sort of specific legal advice to anyone, but in a general sense, what are their rights? Do they have the same constitutional right to free speech as a U.S. citizen or a legal permanent resident? What can you say about that?
What I would say is this. We are, the strategy from the other side is to constantly move the goalposts. It's to constantly keep changing what anti-Semitism is, keep trying to redefine it, and trying to take anything we say to mean anti-Semitism. But what these executive orders do is they're going to be adding like a criminal component to things. So anybody that's here on a visa, whether a student visa or a B1, B2 visitor visa, if they commit a crime or they're arrested, most likely you lose your visa. So what we're going to see within the next 60 days is a layout from the Department of Justice saying, we are going to go after students for trespassing. We're going to go after students for graffiti or vandalism. That underlying charge is what's going to be used as the technical reason why they're going to lose their visa or they're going to be kicked out of the country. So my advice would be this: continue speaking up, continue taking part. I'll never say sit back and don't engage in your First Amendment right, or don't stand up for Palestine or for what you believe in, but do it in a way where you're vigilant and not alarmist. So I would advise international students, for example, from shutting down traffic or taking part in any civil disobedience where you see folks, you know, willingly get arrested. Like, don't take part in those. Figure out for the time being how you can best be involved, where you can be best used, because your voice is stronger when you're here, when you're committed, when you're getting your education, you're doing your part rather than being, you know, removed and unplugged from the movement. So it's be vigilant, not alarmist right now.
That's important. Thank you so much, Abid. And I mean, meanwhile, you know, Harvard University is already facing backlash over its adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism and how it's really bending over backwards to dangerously conflate Judaism with Zionism on behalf of Israel lobby groups and Zionist student organizations and the Israeli government itself. Inside Higher Education this week highlighted a statement written by the university's Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine group, which says, quote, "In accepting the IHRA definition, Harvard has proved itself to be amenable to political pressure rather than intellectual debate. A political scientist and the director of Harvard's Nonviolent Action Lab resigned in protest over the university's, as he said, response to the genocide in Gaza and deepening repression of campus activism around it. He cited the use of the IHRA definition as the final push to leave in his open letter of resignation. How can civil rights organizations like the ADC intervene against the adoption of these policies, such as the IHRA, or protect students and activists if these policies are greenlit? I mean, you know, we talked about free speech, but this is a different level.
This is a different level. And this is the first time we see, someone trying to adopt a definition of hate. We don't see a definition of anti-Black or anti-Arab or Islamophobia. This is beyond any of that. And, you know, as we've been saying, this does water down and this does take away from the fight against real anti-Semitism. And a number of the students and a number of the individuals who've approached ADC for assistance over the past year, year and a half, are actually Jewish students. They're not Arab or Palestinian or Muslim students. We've had a number of Jewish students call us because of what they're facing, right? And the anti-Semitism they're facing. So I think you're going to see that conversation happen from the Jewish community, who's going to be, they're also going to be negatively impacted by this. They're going to be discriminated against. They're going to be targeted as well by these institutions. And, you know, we have to work at putting together our legal strategies, putting together our approaches, but keeping pressure on institutions, state AGs and other lawmakers, and, you know, on a state level who have, you know, are on the fence about this, but letting them know we don't need to adopt the definition. You don't need to go this route. And keep fighting that way. For those that have adopted it, it's going to be litigation. It's going to be like a legal strategy moving forward once it's implemented.
And Abid, tell us about, if you can, about what you're seeing from a bird's eye view on campuses across the United States. Are you seeing an uptick in complaints of harassment and discrimination and targeting of Palestinian students, Arab students, or other students who are simply exercising their right to free speech. What can you tell us about that, let's say, over the last 16 months since the genocide began?
We are seeing an uptake in discrimination and complaints against our students. I would say this, it's a coordinated effort. You're seeing it, you know, you're seeing the harassment of our students at the smallest campuses and the largest campuses. I mean, it's a coordinated effort to go after them, to, you know, bait them, to get them to get into arguments, and they fail, and then they just start harassing the Palestinian students, the encampments. But I do want to add this, on the most part, many universities, smaller universities, mid-sized universities that may not be in the media or may not be well-known, they've been fair. The administration has, you know, protected the students, they've given them space, but it's these hotbed areas like Columbia, NYU, Harvard that get most of the attention. You're seeing, you know, the resources they're putting into quieting the movement. And, you know, unfortunately, they can take this strategy to other campuses. They have the resources to do it. But on the most part, we are seeing an uptick. Unfortunately, we're seeing it from professors, from the administration, from outside groups. It's coming from all directions. It has been coming from all directions over the past 16 months.
And if I could just follow up, Nora. And then, you know, what we saw were during the first Trump administration, when Trump was imposing the so-called Muslim ban and other measures that would target international students or scholars, all these universities put on a pose of we are the champions of academic freedom and free speech, and we're going to protect and defend our students against this. You said some of the smaller or campuses or the ones that are not in the limelight are being fair, but what do you think the situation is now? Are these prestige universities like Harvard and Columbia basically on the same side as Donald Trump? Are they going to be ganging up on our students and scholars? Is that what we can expect?
Yes, that's what we can expect. The order that he signed on the 20th, you know, the ideological exclusion order, that's a dangerous one. That allows for the cancellation of visas or for folks already in the U.S. if there are, you know, if there's disagreement with their ideology. We saw this post 9/11. They can deny visas now if they're, you know, they deem that the applicant has the wrong ideology or view of America. So going after these students, going after folks that have already admitted here, that's dangerous. We have to see how the university is going to apply, but we're already seeing courses canceled, lectures canceled. They're caving in. And the thing is, they're aligning with Donald Trump on this, but I do want to say, it's not like Donald Trump is aligning with his base on this, right? We're also seeing many on the right, many from the Republican Party, they're like, hey, wait a minute, you know, we value our First Amendment rights in this country. We value our freedom of speech, our freedom of expression. What the hell is going on here, right? We're going to see this, I think, become a universal issue where you're going to see folks on the right, folks on the left say, enough. We don't want our rights taken away for a foreign government. So we are noticing that trend, and you're going to start seeing some Republican lawmakers also come out, you know, against what's happening, and I anticipate that happening soon.
Does ADC, you're not a political lobby group in the traditional sense, you're a civil rights organization, or you tell us the range of things you do, but are you talking to lawmakers across the political spectrum in the U.S., as narrow as that spectrum is?
But of course. Of course, yes. Look, we're nonpartisan. We talk to lawmakers and from both parties, and we engage with lawmakers from both parties as long as they stand principally where we are. And I think that right now is very important because the way this administration is set up, the way our politics is set up, it's upside down. Our traditional way of communicating, traditional way of outreach is gone, and you know, relying solely on the Democratic Party or Democratic lawmakers, that's not going to get you anywhere. So there is a realignment of a political realignment happening here of coalitions, allies on these issues. And I think the First Amendment is central to a lot of what we're seeing.
Knowing your rights is a very important tactic for activists and students, especially around Palestine. Can you remind us what our rights are? Do they still even exist under these forms of aggressive and intimidating repression aimed at civil rights and especially aimed at Palestine rights campaigners? You know, if you could break this down in terms of students or faculty on visas, on campuses on the one hand and at the border on the other, What do we all need to know whether or not we are U.S. citizens, and how can we find out more and really, understand deeper what our rights are?
Well, look, as U.S. citizens, I don't anticipate they're going to be going after you for speaking up or for being vocal. As I said, that's your right. That's what you have the ability to do. The scary part is them finding a way to criminalize it, going for some underlying criminal action to get you and to target you and to make your life difficult. So U.S. citizens are going to have more protections, more options, particularly on the border by saying, no, I don't want to give you the right to search my phone. You got to let me in, right? Those exist now. Those that are on student visas or non-immigrant visas or immigrant visas coming into the U.S., their rights are a little bit more limited at the border. You could tell a CBP officer or someone, I don't want to give you my phone, but they're going to tell you, okay, we're going to send you right back, or we're going to cancel your visa. Or even like the ideological exclusion question, oh, well, you agreed with so-and-so, or I see these pictures in your WhatsApp, we're going to deny you entry. So we have to be careful in that. Like what I would advise for those that are here on visas when you're traveling into the country, delete WhatsApp off your phone, come in with a clean slate on WhatsApp, and have your things in order when you do enter. But those that are already in here, speak up, use common sense, don't move away from protesting or having your voice heard, but understand that there is a movement out there against us that is acting in a way that's brazen, that's open, and trying really to defy a lot of what we're against traditionally when it comes to going after our First Amendment rights. So they are using tactics that are frightening, but we'll take them on. But there is a sense of responsibility we have to have. Like I said, don't take part in anything that could get you arrested. Don't take part in any civil disobedience actions. Don't take part in like any graffiti or any of that. Use your voice in the more traditional ways when it comes to protesting. And I hate saying that or putting limits, but I promise you, immediately if a visa holder is put in handcuffs, you can bet that they're going to lose their visa and they're going to be removed. So use common sense, get out there. And again, if you feel threatened or you feel they're targeting you, contact an organization like ADC. Will help you. If you're a professor or you're an administrator and you feel like you're being targeted for your positions, even as a visa holder, you contact an attorney or ADC, because you do have rights as an employee of these institutions. So if you're on J-1 or H-1B, they can't be discriminating against you. And they, there's a whole subset of rights afforded to those folks as well as employees that will protect them.
Abbott, I just want to sort of break this down a little bit further. So you talked about U.S. citizens. Of course, they could find ways, and they have in the past found ways to harass U.S. citizens or make their life more difficult. But in general, U.S. citizens have the highest level of protection. They have to let you in the country. Yeah. If you're coming in from overseas, they can't prevent you coming in the country, and right, they can't force you to let them search your phone or your laptop. Yeah. They are not allowed to force you to answer questions about your ideology or your religion or anything else. If you're a U.S. citizen coming into the United States and they ask you for any of those things, you can say, I don't consent to any search. I don't want to answer any questions. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
All right. Correct. Now, you've already talked about people who are on non-immigrant visas. So that might be people like people who are on student visas, who probably are the most precarious, the most vulnerable, where you're saying use more traditional forms of speech, don't engage in any kind of civil disobedience where you might get arrested. And that sounds fairly reasonable. What about people who are legal permanent residents, otherwise known as green card holders? They're people who are allowed to live in the United States indefinitely without a time limit. Is there a gray area there? What can you say to them?
That's a great question. So green card holders do have rights, and we all have visa holders, green card holders have right to the First Amendment. Now with the green card holders, there are rules that will trigger a removal or deportation. If you are arrested for certain things, you can then be deemed removable from the U.S. And that's when the retainers happen, the ICE detainers. So if a green card holder is protesting, hypothetically, let's say they're arrested for blocking traffic and they're detained here at the Washington, D.C., prison or jail, a notice would be sent to ICE if you know, if there's a working agreement between local officials and ICE, a notice would be sent to ICE saying, hey, we got a green card holder here. You know, here's some arrests. And then things would be done to put that person in removal, and they would ultimately lose their green card. So it is possible if you are arrested for certain things, you can lose your green card. That has happened. And even if you have your green card, you're arrested, and then, you know, years from now, you want to go get your citizenship, that arrest may come back again. You have to re-explain yourself, and you could be at a possibility of not being able to get your citizenship. So it is a something that green card holders need to be aware of. We have seen folks, you know, not related to protests, but we've worked with many individuals who've lost their green card for reasons related to arrests or legal trouble.
And if whether or not you're a U.S. citizen, if police or the FBI come to your door, what are your rights? What should you do? Should you let them in, or should you call a lawyer?
Yeah, that's the quick answer. Is call a lawyer. Don't feel like you know more than them. Don't feel like you're smarter than them. They may be nice. You feel like maybe you have nothing to hide, but you never know what they're there for. You never know what they're trying to get. So I would just call an attorney. Don't fall into the trap of thinking these guys are your friends or they're here. They may be the sweetest people in the world, but do not let them in. Do not engage with them. Call an attorney, have an attorney there with you, have the interview if that's what you want to do, but consult with a lawyer right away.
And I just want to ask, like, what numbers should people save in their phone to call, you know, if someone's, you know, in their 20s or, you know, 40s and they don't have like a lawyer on retainer, what's the best person to call?
You know what? We have a 800 number. It's 844-ADC-9955. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can call. There'll be a human that'll answer. Take your information, get a quick intake from you, and then our attorneys are immediately notified. And if it's something that is involving an arrest or an FBI visit or something, it is elevated, and we respond almost as fast as we can. And then we try to immediately connect you with an attorney in your city if we're unable to get out there.
That's really an incredible resource and so important to know. And again, I'm coming to some basics, and this is very much on my mind because I've just been through this, albeit in another country, but there are a lot of similarities. When I was arrested last Saturday, the first thing I said is, I want a lawyer. I want to talk to a lawyer. And I refuse to be questioned or talk to police without a lawyer. Is that what people should also do in the United States?
They should. They should talk to a lawyer. Now, Ali, what you went through, you know, I was explaining to somebody here, what you went through is kind of like the accelerated process of what happens here. Unfortunately, in the U.S., you know, the end result is the same. But this individual, if this had happened to you here, the individual was spending weeks in a detention center or in a holding cell, right? So it's a much slower process here. And, you know, that's intentionally done just to keep you, you know, regretting your choice of ever coming to the U.S. and having you leave. And rules are a little bit different in immigration holding facilities. They may not give you time to call a lawyer, or they may skip over your time or ignore you. So it is important that you have, you know, if somebody is here as a student visa and they're engaging or they feel, you know, they're at risk, share your information with a friend or with a family member that's in the U.S., copy of your passport, copy of your I-20, your basic information. Just in the event, you know, something does happen, that person, that individual can turn that information over to an attorney and work to find you and work to assist you while you're, you know, in detention.
One other question I want to get, or one other thing I want to get you to comment on. If the FBI or the police come to your door, you've already said you don't have to talk to them. You're not required to talk to them. And in fact, you probably shouldn't. You should just say to them, if you want, give me your card and I'll get my lawyer to call you. And you don't let them in your house, you don't talk to them. But another thing that I've heard, and I want you to tell us if it's accurate or not, is that the FBI and the police are allowed to lie to you. They're allowed to lie about why they're there, and they're allowed to lie about what they know about you or what they don't know. But if you lie to them, that could land you in prison.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not worth lying. It's not worth just having that conversation without a lawyer. Don't lie to them. Don't engage. Like you said, take their business card and go, because they will lie to you. Again, they will say, oh, we're your friend, or we're here. We just want to make sure you're safe. We just want to make sure no one is threatening you. And then one thing leads to another and you find yourself in legal trouble. So don't lie to them. That's why you should have the attorney there with you to make sure, you know, everything you say is in order and not going to get you in trouble.
And then we've been talking about the United States because of Donald Trump's order, but we have viewers all over the world. Many countries where we have viewers have very similar legal systems. Could be Canada, could be the UK. There are differences in these systems, but many of these general principles apply in those countries as well. And people who are in those countries who are concerned about these things should probably brush up on what their rights are in their own countries in terms of if they're at a protest and they're arrested, or which has been happening a great deal, especially in the UK, where we're seeing people charged for tweets, criminally charged for tweets, criminally charged for signs they're carrying at protests, where there are far fewer protections for free speech. So although we may not have the expertise about each and every country, it's a good general principle, do you think, Abed, for people to brush up on their rights?
Absolutely, absolutely. Brush up on your rights, find the local attorney or find your local version of ADC or the National Lawyers Guild. They are in a lot of these countries out there, you know, attorneys ready to support and help, but you do want to have this information on hand, particularly if you're part of the movement and part of the activities and the protests that have been going on. Very important to do so.
And if go ahead.
No, go ahead, Nora.
If you could give out the number for your hotline once more, Abed, and also tell us how we can reach you online as well.
Sure. It's 844-ADC-9955. Our website is adc.org, and our email is legal@adc.org. So you can get a hold of us anyway, and we'll do our best to respond.
So adc.org is probably a good place to start.
Yes.
Abed, thank you so much for joining us. This is critical information, and we always learn from you. And thank you for the work you're doing for the community. It's never been more vital, and we hope to have you back again.
I appreciate you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Abed.
What you just heard was an interview with Abed Ayoub, National Executive Director for ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, conducted by the Electronic Intifada. For more information on the Electronic Intifada, visit www.electronicintifada.net, and more information about ADC is at adc.org, and I have a link to both organizations on our website, arabvoices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.